Today is Thursday, February 25th. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order, and I know it doesn't look it, but we do have a quorum, and members will be coming to the table. So for people here to present their bills, don't be nervous. The first bill on the agenda today is Senate File 2383, Senator Dill. Senator Dill, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the time for this hearing. This is a bill that we've been working on for the past year. There was actually two bills that we were working on, and we've chosen to withdraw one of them. This bill deals with the use of part of the marriage license fee. In Minnesota, if you have 12 hours of pre-marriage education with an emphasis on conflict management and communication skills, and to include a pre-marriage inventory, you can buy your marriage license for $40, and if you don't, it costs $110. And out of the $110 fee, under current law, there's $5 of that has been going to the University of Minnesota for a project called the Minnesota Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood Initiative. That program was funded two-thirds with federal money and one-third with state money from this $5 fee. That program has now ended in the final report has been written. We would like to take that $5 and put it on a new program, which is called Minnesota Couples on the Brink Project. It's an idea that has come from Dr. Bill Doherty of the University of Minnesota. He's written 10 or 11 books on marriage, divorce, and family matters, and is a real expert on this. And he's seated to my right. And on my left is Judge Bruce Peterson, who is a Hennepin County family law judge, who's been working with Dr. Doherty on this project. And I believe that the judge is going to be the first one to speak on this proposal.
Very good. Senator Dill, I believe that you have an author's amendment that maybe we should put on the bill before we go forward.
Madam Chair, I would like to. I talked to Senator Betzel about it ahead of time because he had something to do with it last year. It's an amendment that changes a small item that we had last session on whether or not the paper that the educator provides to the court or to the courthouse when the marriage license is being purchased to indicate whether 12 hours of pre-marriage education has been provided. And the change was that we require that document be notarized. And that's an inconvenient thing to ask a minister to do or a priest, or just a little inconvenient to go downtown and try to find a notary public, and it just slows everything up. And I've been checking around a little bit, and you know, there's some support for this, but there's also a lot of support for retreating and not requiring it, because there really, as far as we can tell, very little graft in this whole system, and we'd like to make it a little easier and not require the notarization. So that's what the amendment does. I don't know how Senator Betzel feels about it.
Well, Senator Betzel?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is not directly related to the bill, but if Senator Dill wants to have the discussion. I did carry a bill on behalf of the County Recorders Association where they went through a lot of the notary requirements and changed it. And actually, one of the bills got vetoed because of the notary fee increase. We passed some of the things. We also passed a bill last year that is currently in the Finance Committee because the House wasn't able to pass it. So I wasn't able to get back to my office to track it down. I think it's okay. I don't remember the rationale why they wanted to have that changed. And I think I'm certainly willing to do so, but I think that, you know, this group probably would have not have had any notice about this coming on up. So Senator Dill, if I'll be okay to put it on the bill, but I think, you know, if we hear some concerns or issues, perhaps you're going to be – would you be willing to revisit it later on if they come back with the compelling information why they did? I just don't remember what the rationale was right now.
Yeah. Senator Dill?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that's a very appropriate, I think, position to take. We can put it on right now, and we'll see what the public reaction is, and then take appropriate action later if it's negative.
And I have a fallback anyway, Madam Chair, because, again, my notary bill is still in the Finance Committee. And so if the House moves on, which I think they will – we can either correct it there or here if there's any problems. So, So I have a fallback. So thank you.
Senator Betzel moves the A1 amendment to put Senate File 2383 in the shape that the author would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. So, members, the bill is very short. There are two components. There's a finance component, and then the policy component is establishing this program called Couples on the Brink, or this project. And so we're going to hear from the testifiers on the program. The bill is going to go to finance, I guess, to have a conversation about the redirecting or the modification of the fee. But I'm sure that if you all have a question about that, we certainly could discuss it, but I just want to put that on the table. Judge Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bruce Peterson. I'm a Hennepin County judge. I'm here on my own behalf today. The judicial branch has taken no position on this bill. I think I got Dr. Doherty into this project, and I really want to thank him for the professional and diligent way he's pursued this. I've spent about seven of the last 8 years in family court in Hennepin County, and I was always a little concerned because there was a certain number of people that I wondered if they really needed a divorce. They often, people I would see who would sit comfortably together, maybe laugh together, solve problems together. I'm talking about a small percentage now. Most people very much are there because they need to proceed with the process. But we're a busy court, and our motivation is always to move cases along and get ready for the next case. And I wondered if in this subset of cases we were doing a disservice to people because there really were no services, there were no provisions for people who might want to rethink their decision to proceed with a divorce. So I called up Dr. Doherty. I didn't know him. I'd read one of his books. I'd heard him speak. And I asked him what the research was on couples who began a divorce process and changed their mind, and if it was a significant number, and if there's something we could do to help these couples reach a good decision. The reason this is important, of course, is because we know that the research is that overall, children of divorcing parents show less well-being and higher risk on a number of important issues. So, like a true academic, what Dr. Doherty did is he said, let's get some data. He conducted survey research for about 2 years in our court, and I think he'll tell you about that, developed some statistics about the number of people who, in fact, are not sure about their decision to proceed with a divorce. He pulled together a working group of lawyers to discuss how these couples looked from their point of view, what lawyers were seeing in their offices about couples seeing them for divorce, learned that there are other issues besides perhaps just people might want to think about reconciliation. There's a need for services for what we've come to call leavees. In most divorces, there's a leaver and a leavee. Often there are people who are quite angry and hurt and bitter because they're left behind. They can sabotage the divorce process. They can cause difficulties in the parenting relationship for a long time thereafter. There's no specialized services for those sorts of people. Dr. Doherty discovered another need for something he now calls discernment coaching to help people reach the decision to divorce in a very principled and honest fashion and not come to it out of anger or pain, which then is reflected in the way they proceed with each other. Dr. Doherty conducted this research over a period of a couple years and came up with the idea of this Couples on the Brink project, which would be a project administered through the University of Minnesota and to which we as judges could refer couples that we see who we think might be amenable to such services, could provide research and education to practitioners in the field, and would be a resource to address this population which right now is not being served. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judge. Any questions? Dr. Doherty.
Judge Peterson did such a nice, good job of summarizing it. I will just add a couple of points. Our survey was with 2,500 divorcing parents in Hennepin County, and we found that in about one of four divorcing parents in Hennepin County believed that their marriage might be saved if they worked on it. And one in three said they were potentially interested in reconciliation services. And if you match up those by couples, it was one in 10 couples where both people independently surveyed said that they could potentially be interested in reconciliation services. Madam Chairwoman, I assure you that right now the state of the art out there among therapists, I trained marriage and family therapists at the university for 20-some years, and among divorce lawyers, is that once people file, it's a done deal. Get them through the process constructively. I never thought that was the case. Judge Peterson didn't think. We now have data from 2,500 people that, in fact, there is a small but significant subset who would be interested in specialized services. Right now, there isn't enough out there for these people. So we have developed, as Judge Peterson said, discernment coaching, what we call hopeful spouse coaching for somebody who does not want the divorce, but they're often behaving quite poorly and thereby convincing their spouse that they should leave them. And we have developed ways to help those folks bring their best self to this process so that even if they do get divorced, it's healthier, but also possibly saving the relationship. And then something we call reconciliation coaching for couples where they both want to salvage the relationship. Right now what happens is they get referred to one more marriage counselor who may or may not have enough power behind the service to really help people. So we've developed a variety of services. The goal of this bill is to continue to develop and refine these services and to train professionals, counselors, clergy, and others around the state in this work. For instance, a lot of clergy deal with couples right on the brink, and they often don't know what to do with these couples, don't know where to send them. Talk to a number of clergy who could benefit from the kind of training we could offer, as well as counselors and lawyers. The funding mechanism, I know that'll be done later. Senator Dill and I were responsible for that first, for the initial funding of this. It's the Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood Project that we did through the University of Minnesota for 5 years. And that project is about healthy marriage and family formation among urban low-income couples. And so that project was about healthy marriage, promoting among people who are unmarried to parents who want it. This project continues in the spirit of that, by helping couples who are at the brink of ending their marriage perhaps save their marriage. And one more comment, Madam Chairwoman. This is, for me, like an insurance policy. There are a lot of $5 surcharges on the marriage license fee now for all kinds of things. 40% of the couples getting married in the state this year are going to be facing the prospect of divorce if the current statistics hold. This is putting into place some capability, some capacity in the state of Minnesota to help those couples when they are at the threshold of divorce, if in fact they're open to trying to save their marriages. So I think of all of the surcharges on the marriage license fee, this is the one that fits best the situation of married couples, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it here today.
Dr. Doherty, is there at the University of Minnesota, is the program currently operating at the University of Minnesota?
Yes, the Couples on the Brink project is operating. We have a little bit of grant funding for it.
Dr. Doherty, do you have any people who come to the program on a fee-for-service basis?
Right now, because it's a grant, we're providing the services for free.
If the couples are economically able to do it, do you think or do you have some thoughts about going in the direction of a fee-for-service?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes. At some point, this would provide about $100,000 per year, which would provide a coordinator and some particularly one of the things for low-income folks, we want to train students and junior professionals to do this work, so that can be very low-income. But $100,000 is not going to sustain the whole project. It would provide a base for it. And so what we're looking into is a fee-for-service for those who can afford it.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair and Dr. Doherty, so that's $100,000 out of the other program, the Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood?
Dr. Doherty?
Thank you for the clarification. That project has ended. It was a five-year project.
Oh.
So the Healthy Marriage Responsible Fatherhood project is done. We filed our final report. The $5 surcharge is still there, is still coming in. So the question is, does that end? Is it used for something else? And so we're suggesting it be used for this.
So then, Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins,
is the language on 2.11 through 13 correct? If the other one has been finished, shouldn't this be proposed to replace the language in that paragraph rather than be an or? I don't know.
Madam Chair?
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I think you're pointing out a good thing. I was wondering about the same thing since the program has ended, and I've got the final report here from Dr. Doherty that I don't think we need that name in there anymore. But we should ask Kathy Pontius because she drafted the amendment.
Ms. Pontius, is there any reason to continue to keep that language in the bill, or is it because we've created it that now that the purpose is done, we can terminate it?
Madam Chair, members, I think you could just delete the references to the Fatherhood Initiative under the assumption that there will never be any more federal matching money because the use of the state money is contingent on federal matching funds. I don't know if that would become available again in the future or not.
It's done, so I think that's done. Makes sense.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins,
in paragraph C, the language saying that it's contingent upon receiving federal funding would then go away as well?
Let's see. I would think so, Senator Higgins, if we are again, I think that I guess this is, we certainly could look at it. I think this would be the conversation in finance. But I think you did the original program, the language had to be like this because it had to be contingent on federal funding. If we're redirecting this money to this new program, I'm assuming that there is no longer a federal contingency.
That's right, Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe for the Finance Committee, then Ms. Pontius can figure out the correct amendment and have it for Senator Dill. Somebody, anyway.
Right. I think those pieces do, we should look at it. But Senator Dill will work with Ms. Pontius and we can figure out how to clean that up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I haven't had an opportunity to read this, and what I'm trying to figure out is exactly what the situation is and how this fits into the process that so we know what goes on here, basically.
Sure.
And I'm concerned in a divorce situation, in most cases it seems to me that there's some kind of I can't focus on it, but in any event, with the maltreatment of one or the other, the spouse.
So I think Senator Foley's question is, at what stage do people get either referred to or become part of the project? Yes. Dr. Doherty?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We have developed, actually, for the last project, we're carrying over to this one, a domestic abuse assessment and referral system. We developed it with the Tubman Family Alliance, which is one of the oldest domestic abuse programs. So there is an assessment when people call in. There is a written assessment, and then we also call to make sure that there is no order of protection filed for the couple. So there's three layers of provision in our project to make sure people don't get in and try to save a marriage that is facing substance abuse. And then we have a referral network. If somebody, if they're not in our project, we can refer them out. That's a very important issue.
Dr. Doherty, though, at what point, how do you get the referrals? Do the courts refer them directly to you, or can people who are contemplating it, who knows about the project, just come to you on their own?
Madam Chair, they're coming all kinds of ways. Some people are finding out about it. Some are referred by lawyers, the judges. We actually have started to send a simple survey to newly filing people, and they're responding. So there is a real, what we're finding is there's a real need for this out there.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Dill, for bringing this bill forward. I think the intent of the bill is really a good one. I have a little bit of a question, though, just in terms of, I'm just thinking, real practical examples of the kinds of people who may find themselves in these situations. As I think has already been pointed out, there are some situations where one spouse or the other might not want the divorce, and the other one does. And in those situations, there's not much you can do to force the two of them to stay together. I think that's probably kind of a pointless endeavor. But there are other situations, like you said, perhaps those 1 in 10, where you know, both may say they don't want the divorce, and yet on the other hand, there might be something underlying, like whether it's the alcoholism on the part of one, and the other one would love to not have to divorce but doesn't want to continue to deal with it, or gambling, or, you know, whatever the issue in that particular circumstance might be. And so we've kind of always known that there are situations where counseling for people and having access to counseling for these kinds of issues will help that couple to figure out if they really have to have the divorce or not. So I guess my situation, or my question, is, I think, somewhat like Senator Foley's, is how does this fit into the process that we already have in place? And you know, is it different than addressing those kinds of issues, or making sure counseling is available for those kinds of issues? And then the other comment that I was going to make is just that, from my perspective as a lawyer, although this isn't an area of that I've practiced in, but it seems like the comment was made, you know, once the filing happens, it seems like people are on a road that never really gets reevaluated about this. Is this really the best thing, or what the couple really wants? And we have a system set up that once lawyers are involved, often they each, not that they're bad, but they each seem to have their job to do, and it tends to become perhaps more adversarial, whether the couple gets divorced or not, than necessarily it needs to be. And so we have mediation, and we've more and more relied on mediation as a way within our court system to try to avoid those kinds of escalations. And I'm just wondering, in an even bigger picture way, if we think about the cost that we have in our court system today, I know someone in California that just got divorced recently, and they didn't even, I don't think, make a court appearance. It was done online, but they had to go through mediation. And I'm not suggesting we should make it easier for people to get divorced, but I am suggesting that there might be a way to save money all the way around, and perhaps building in the concept of what you're talking about, make sure that we save those marriages that can be saved, and then for those who aren't, that aren't savable, we decrease the animosity that gets caused and the costs.
Well, Madam
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Olson, for that question. We last year we had a bill that dealt with this issue before us, plus another issue, and we put it into two bills this year, both of which we were going to hear today, but we withdrew one of them. And the one we withdrew really deals with partly with what you're talking about. It was a Right now we have a pre-divorce education program that is required for parents divorcing with underage children. And out in the countryside, it's usually the Minnesota Extension Services program called Parents Forever. It's a 12-hour program. And it teaches parents how to be parents forever. And they may not like it when they start the class, but almost all of them are happy they took it when they got done. The proposal we had that we're not dealing with today was to have a pre-divorce filing education program, which would be similar to what is required before bankruptcy court. Before you can file for bankruptcy, you have to go through a pre-bankruptcy training program so you know what's ahead of you. The pre-divorce filing program would talk about some of the same things Parents Forever talk about, but it would also talk about what you're talking about, mediation. So before the couple actually gets into the judicial system, they would be advised of the opportunity to go through mediation, and which is a much less controversial way of, and less confrontational way of getting a divorce, and also the possibility of reconciliation counseling. And so they know what's ahead of them, so they can decide before they even file whether they should go forward. Well, we're not bringing that bill forward today. We're going to spend another year looking at it and studying it and trying to decide what's appropriate. And there'll be a task force set up to do that.
Members, I sense that we're moving into the discussion stage of the bill, and we have one more testify who would like to give us her thoughts on the bill, and then we can have a discussion on it. So let's see, Ms. Pamela Wagner. Ms. Wagner, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Pamela Wagner. I am the current chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association's Family Law Section. I'm also a practitioner in family law. I have been an attorney in family law, working exclusively in family law since 1994, so it's quite some time. I am here, though, Madam Chair, to talk about the section's vote that was opposing Senator Dill's bill, the 2383 Senate file. With all due respect, the section on Saturday had a discussion with regard to this bill and had several concerns that resulted in the opposition. One was that the $5 fund for the Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood Initiative was enacted in 2004 in Minnesota Statute Section 256.742. The purpose of that bill and the targeted population of that bill and that law, actually, as it exists today on the books, was to deal with urban unmarried parents. That was in response to the statistic that's overwhelming at this point, that 32% of the children in Minnesota are born to unmarried parents. So the $5 that is now going to be assigned would basically cancel out the purpose of 256.742, which was the Responsible Fatherhood Initiative. The concern of this section is that $5, rather than dealing with a 1% population, if it's 1 in 10, that would be 1% population of folks who are looking to perhaps work on the marriage, those funds would be better used, again, to continue to support the programs that some of those funds have gone to under 256.742. In other words, education about parenting, education about co-parenting, education about domestic violence. Senator Foley made a very good point about substance abuse, but I think also what is a part very much of people who are in divorce situations is domestic violence. There is not always an order for protection. In fact, I can't quote statistics on that, but I know that many people do not go in to court for an order for protection despite the fact that there is domestic violence. And we're not just talking violence, we're talking coercion, intimidation, and threats. I don't know that this bill really is appropriate to rechannel funding from the Fatherhood Initiative over to a new program that's seeking to assist people in reconciling their marriages. As part of the study that this bill was based on, it was determined that a good majority of the 2,500 people had sought counseling, couples counseling, prior to the dissolution of the marriage. Now we are sending them again, potentially, to more counseling, and not only that, we are funding it publicly rather than funding it privately. And the section has a problem with that, given the kinds of funding crunches that we're in to date. In addition, the reconciliation, actually there is a point within the dissolution process in the law right now that people can attempt reconciliation. They can put basically the divorce proceeding on hold while they go and attempt reconciliation or counseling or direct negotiation with one another to try and work out their marriage problems. They can do that by placing the matter on inactive status. So requiring people or trying to say that this is the only way that people will attempt reconciliation is perhaps not not based on the reality of the divorce situation. So again, the reasoning behind the section's objection to this is the fact of the funding being better used, perhaps, in going toward those programs for domestic violence and for parent education and for treating or for addressing the issues that arise and the population that has arisen under 256.742, which was the focus of that program, was unmarried urban parents. It's in the purpose of the bill and can be read in 256.742. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Thank you very much. Senator Dill, your bill doesn't mandate that all couples who are going through dissolution go through this program, does it?
Madam Chair, it's entirely voluntary. But we have one of the best and most revered marriage and family therapists in the world sitting right here to run this program. Right. He's got a wonderful record of doing excellent work throughout his life. He's been on the Oprah Winfrey Show. He's been on all kinds of national programs talking about his
his work. Is this being recorded? I'm sorry.
He's written 10 or 12 books on this subject, and I have a lot of confidence in him. I've worked with him for many years, and there's a lot of marriage counselors and ministers out there doing the very best they can, but with additional assistance from Dr. Doherty and with this program, they can do a better job that they're facing in their practices and their work. And hopefully this will lay the groundwork for some more work next year when we talk about pre-divorce filing education, if we get to that point.
Dr. Doherty, currently how many staff people do you have working on this project? And do you have a number of how many people you're serving now?
We have just three of us, Madam Chair, just very much part-time. We've really just begun. We have about 12 couples we've been working with in an organized fashion on this. Although my own work over the last 20 years has been piecing together aspects of this, we just organized the project in the last 6 months, and we're doing the piloting. We've also recruited a group of highly competent therapists. We also, Madam Chair, have – this is an example of how we're adding things to the current services. We have 18 married couples who have reconciled after being in the throes of divorce, who serve as ambassadors of hope, who make a mentoring phone call to the couples that come into our project telling their stories. I don't know if Judge Peterson came back up again.
Judge Peterson?
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I was interested in this, because I hear a lot about counseling, and people say we tried counseling, which, you know, it didn't work. What Dr. Doherty and his team have put together is an array of services, including counseling with therapists that have been trained by him and selected for their expertise in this particular area, which is a very specialized area, mentoring couples who have been there and solved their problem and can provide hope, intensive weekends, some of these marriage intensive weekends, which I've heard couples talk about. So I've watched Dr. Doherty put together an array of services that would be much more focused and effective than, frankly, the counseling, which is, in my mind, often I hear about ineffective counseling. So it's much more than that.
Well, Dr. Doherty, I find the project compelling and interesting. My only thinking on that is that I think that it's appropriate for public dollars perhaps to go towards the development or the fully development of that project, but I will hope that as you move forward, and perhaps you could have this conversation in the Finance Committee, that maybe you sunset state or public funding of the project once you have evolved to the beyond the development stage and really make this kind of a maybe sliding fee or fee for service, just like any other kind of counseling business that people go through, because it's certainly, if it's compelling, I think that people will want to take advantage of that.
I'm sure that makes complete sense to me, yes. Yeah.
Any further discussions with Senator Dill or the witnesses? Anybody want to move the bill? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 2383 be referred to Finance.
The full Finance Committee. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Dill. Members of the committee, thank you very much.
Senate File 1281, Senator Hahn.
Notary bill on
what he did.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And it is a pleasure to be back in front of the Judiciary Committee. I was a one-time member of this committee, and I know the due diligence that this committee brings to all the bills that it examines, and so I'm very happy to be here. Madam Chair and members, I have first Senate File 1281, which involves changing the structure of a marriage dissolution in the event that there are minor children as a part of the marriage. And this is an issue that I have been concerned about for some time. I think all of us have experienced in some way through friends or relatives or close family members the reality of divorce. It's very common in our society. And it is particularly tragic when there are children involved, I believe, and there are, I think, compelling studies and that have shown that divorce is not a good thing for children. I just want to read you very briefly a statement that Michael Reagan, the son of the former president, he wrote a book called Twice Adopted, where his assessment was, and I quote here, "Divorce is where adults take everything that matters to a child, the child's home, family, security, and a sense of being loved and protected, and they smash it all up, leave it in ruins on the floor, and then walk out and leave the child to clean up the mess." And I think we all know that, and there are, again, studies that show that divorce, children of divorce are much more likely to have difficulties in school, to become pregnant, more likely to live in poverty, more likely to end up in the prison system. And so anything I believe that we can do to try to encourage, if we can, people who are beginning to or going through the process or contemplating divorce to put some break on that when there are minor children involved and try to see if there is an opportunity for reconciliation is a good thing. I do want to say that after we introduced this bill last year, I received an email last summer from Carol McAllister. I did not know who this person was. She had read about the bill being introduced and sent me an email, and I think you have a copy of that. And she expressed and told, I thought, a very compelling story of her own experience in divorce. And I was touched by that, and when we were invited to present this bill to the committee, I sent her a message and asked if she'd be willing to come up and testify. And so Carol McAllister is here. She lives in Austin, Minnesota, and works at the Mayo Clinic, so she came up from Rochester and is able to be here with us this afternoon, and I do want to give her an opportunity to tell her story as well. But maybe before we do that, I'd like to move very quickly a couple of very small author amendments. One is, Madam Chair, on page 2 of the bill, the effective date. And I understand this is fairly common. It says August 9, 2009. That's obviously not going to work. I would like to change that to be 2010. And then secondly, as an oral amendment, if I could, on page 1 of the bill, line 15, 1.15, where it talks about one of the conditions being a refusal to seek or comply with treatment or aftercare for chemical dependency, and I would like to add the words after that at the end of line 1.15, or gambling addiction. And if I could offer that as an author's amendment, I would like to do so.
Madam Chair, I'd move that on his behalf.
Yep. Senator Parasol moves
or gambling, it would change the
language relating to line 2.25, striking 2009 and inserting 2010. And then on line 1.15, at the end of dependency, include or gambling addiction. And that will be an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape the author would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, just to very briefly, it's not a very long bill. The substance of the bill would be to permit a dissolution of a marriage in the event that there are minor children involved, only after a 2-year waiting period or upon the court finding one of the following grounds that are listed in the bill is in fact in existence, which would include adultery, domestic abuse, refusal to comply with treatment for chemical dependency or gambling addiction, or desertion for 2 years. And That's essentially the substance of the bill, and I do want to give Ms. McAllister a chance to tell us a little bit about her story. So if we could, take her testimony. Thank you.
Ms. McAllister, welcome to the committee, and please just restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carol McAllister, and I'm from Austin, Minnesota.
Please proceed.
First of all, I would like to say that I am in complete support of the proposed two-year waiting period for the contested dissolutions involving minor children. In my opinion, our society wants instant gratification. We want everything, and we want it now. Instant messaging, instant wealth, instant food, instant divorce, so you can move on with your life. A two-year waiting period, I believe, would allow a couple a cooling-off period, a time for reflection, a time to fully understand the consequences of the dissolution, a time to work on their marriage, and a time for forgiveness. It's my prayer that Minnesota can become a state that promotes the institution of marriage and the reconciliation of families, rather than contributing to the destruction of families. I'd like to quote from Hillary Clinton in her It Takes a Village book on page 43. She says, "With divorce as easy as it is and its consequences so hard, people with children need to ask themselves whether they have given their marriage their best shot and what more they can do to make it work before they call it quits." Secretary of State Hillary Clinton believes that it should be much harder to get a divorce when children are involved, and she believes that divorce has become too easy because of permissive laws and attitudes towards divorce. My five children and I have personally experienced the ease with which divorce can be granted with our current no-fault dissolution without a waiting period, and I'd like to share just a portion of our story. The day after our oldest son's high school graduation open house, I came home from work, and I found my husband's belongings and him gone. I had no clue it was coming, not a clue in the world. He didn't leave me a note. There was no phone call. There was no discussion. There was no sitting the kids down and telling them that this was going to happen. Nothing. He didn't even leave me a phone number or an address where I could contact him or the kids could contact him. I was in just total shock, barely able to function, crying hysterically, but only focusing on me until I looked up and I saw my children, my five children. The pain, the shock, the disbelief on the faces of my five children. I knew that I had to pull myself together at that point in time and stand for my marriage and the reconciliation of our family. Over the course of the next few days, I learned that my husband had moved in with another woman, and 3 weeks later, a divorce was in the works. Our five children were devastated. The safe world that they had known had been ripped apart in a few weeks by separation and pending divorce. They soon began to find very inappropriate ways to mask their pain. Our youngest son regressed in his behavior. Kids had missing homework. They had a cavalier attitude towards school. Our daughter was losing weight, not eating properly. Our older boys were lashing out in anger, rebellion, drug and alcohol abuse. An example of this is our third son snuck out of the house during the middle of the night and was picked up by a police officer for minor consumption. The police officer brought him home to our house, and the officer called me out in the driveway, and he said that he had asked my son why he was out in the middle of the night drinking. And the officer told me that my son had told him that his dad had left home and his parents were getting a divorce, and he was drinking to drown the pain that he was feeling. I did not want the divorce, despite all the circumstances, and believed with all my heart that reconciliation was possible. The divorce proceeded because my husband did want it, but I did prepare a letter for the court that I'd like to read to you when we were in court.
Ms. McAllister, do you think you could maybe give us the letter that we can pass around?
Oh,
we
sure.
have. I'm so sorry. Your story is really compelling. You came a really long way, and I don't want to cut you off, but we have a number of other bills.
That's fine.
And is that all right? Can
no,
you can you summarize for us the crucial point, because I'm sure it made an impression with the court, and we'd like to know that.
Well, the main thing was that I had said that I did not believe that our marriage was irreconcilable, that there was a irretrievable breakdown. So I had actually requested, because I could not sign that divorce paper with that in there, because I did not believe that there was an irreconcilable differences and an irretrievable breakdown. So I asked the judge if that could be taken out of the divorce decree, and it was. So since you have to prove that there is an irretrievable breakdown in the marriage relationship, the judge had to put my husband on the stand that day, and he testified that our marriage was irretrievably broken with no chance of reconciliation, so the divorce was granted. My desires didn't matter. We were married for over 25 years at that time, and we left 5 devastated, broken-hearted children because of our selfishness. My husband and I began moving towards reconciliation less than 10 months after the divorce was finalized, and we were totally reconciled within 15 months. And I do want to emphasize, because I know that adultery is a clause in the proposed bill, but I do want to emphasize that marriages can be reconciled even with adultery. If the 2-year waiting period that is proposed in this bill would have been in effect in 2007, I believe that our divorce could have been prevented. And the 2-year waiting period would have saved our family over $30,000 in combined legal fees, $35,000 in inpatient treatment fees for 2 of our sons, and $10,000 in counseling fees for myself and our 5 children. But more importantly, there's no price tag that can be put on the value of the reduction of pain and suffering that the 2-year waiting period would have offered our children. And in closing, I prayed fervently for God to stop our divorce. And when he allowed it to happen, I kept questioning, why? Why, God? Why did this happen? But now that I'm here today, perhaps my divorce was allowed, so I did experience, and I could come and testify today and share my personal testimony with you in hopes of getting this proposal approved. And so if our experience saves even one family from the divorce, then the pain that our family endured will be worth every moment of it. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and thank you for making the trip to be here. Our next witness.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and Ms. McAllister, it just seems to me that if this bill, exactly as we have it, had been on the books at the time of your situation, the judge still could have granted the divorce because of the exception for adultery. If your husband had come to court and said, yes, I've been in an adulterous relationship, then there would have not have been a 2-year cooling off period. The divorce would have been granted.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, thanks. I was actually just going to point out the same thing Senator Betzel just said, and I was going to add to that that in addition to the costs your family incurred, you would have had even greater costs because you would have had to go through your husband would have had to go through the expense and actually the escalation of probably hard feelings that would have been caused around proving the fact of adultery. And so, you know, I'm really glad that for your sake and your husband's sake and all of your family's sake that you've been able to reconcile. And I know that there are some states that have short cooling off periods like 6 months, but they don't introduce the concept of fault back into marriage. And just like what we were taught, if you were sitting in on the testimony of the bill before, which is geared toward trying to help people save their marriages and encourage that, which I think is a value that we all share. But at the same time, for probably the majority of people who aren't going to reconcile in these situations, the idea is to try to not increase the animosity, to not increase the situation that would make it get harder on their kids and harder for them to deal with parenting as things go forward in the future. So that's the concern that I have with your bill, with this bill. I don't think it really does what it said, you know, what it's purported to do, and I think going backwards in terms of increasing animosity potentially for people would be the wrong direction.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Betzel and Senator Olson. I appreciate your comments, and I think in the course of trying to construct the bill, what we were trying to recognize is that we're not trying to necessarily introduce cause, but to recognize that in the case of children, there should be some opportunity for this to be put on hold, but also recognizing that even with children, there may be circumstances in which a divorce ought to be granted. If there is abuse, if there is substance or other kinds of issues in the marriage that would make it problematic or more advantageous to grant the divorce, we shouldn't say, well, no divorce, continue to have the abusive relationship go on. So the point was to try to construct some exceptions that were reasonable. Now, if the committee feels that adultery is not a reasonable exception, I'd be willing to entertain a motion to remove that as an exception. But the point was to try to give some waiting period in the case of children. Well,
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair. Senator Hahn, I do believe this goes backwards. I mean, the law used to presume that parties, when they are married, should remain married. That was the law. But then the law recognized there should be exceptions. That, you know, there should be reasons why. But then the parties came to court, sometimes having to manufacture reasons within the exceptions. And if we take out adultery, if parties want out, they'll find a way, you know, to use one of the exceptions, whatever it is. Mental cruelty used to be one of the exceptions. So parties would come to court and have to make up reasons why there was mental cruelty or whatever the reasons were. And finally, every state in the union decided this isn't working, because if one party wants out, no matter how hard it is on the other party or the other or the children, it's not going to be working out. They're going to find a way to get out. And so every state decided that the better way is, okay, if one party absolutely wants out, fine, you know, that part's dissolved, then you deal with the other issues of custody, you deal with all the other the property separation and so forth. So I think that this proposal actually goes backwards, and parties are going to try to manufacture reasons for whatever we put in the bill, and I don't think that I don't think that's going to work. So,
Senator Olson?
Well, and Madam Chair, I guess I can't say that I have the statistics in front of me to support this, but it seems like the exceptions that you're listing are the main reasons why people get divorced, including, you know, the testifier that we heard from today. So if you're going to say that, you know, so then it seems to me that in the majority of situations, all you're really doing is you're introducing the concept of fault back into this process, which is an ugly thing for two people to have to go through or their kids to have to be exposed to, and makes it harder for them to reconcile after you drag them through all of this fault-based stuff than if that weren't the case.
Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Hahn, Ms. McAllister, I understand what you're trying to accomplish here, which is the opportunity for reconciliation before something becomes final, especially when there are children involved in the home. But I agree in one sense with my colleagues that we are going back to that whole concept of fault. I don't think that was ever really a good idea. And so maybe you could simplify your bill, and it might accomplish the same thing. If instead you said that the court could only grant a dissolution when a minor is involved, only after a one-year waiting period, leave out all of the other justifications and just say, that's it. There will be a one-year waiting period. It doesn't mean that a spouse can't leave the home, but the divorce doesn't become final until after a one-year waiting period. It may be more workable for the type of thing that you're trying to accomplish without running afoul of what the concerns are here, and I tend to agree with these concerns, that we don't want to get into that in court, but maybe that waiting period is something you're still trying to accomplish.
It sounds like we're moving into the discussion phase, and I think these are some good questions to ask, Senator Hand. We have two other witnesses who would like to testify on the bill, so why don't we hear from them, and then we can have a conversation. Mr. Pritchard. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Tom Pritchard, President of Minnesota Family Council, and we'd like to speak in favor of the bill. And I applaud you, Senator, for allowing this bill to come forward. Divorce is obviously a difficult situation. So many people have been affected by it. But I think it's significant. The consequences are enormous and have been for society. And I think we have concerns about the no-fault system, and we think this is a reasonable effort to move away from it. There's been some comments made about the conflict that was designed to eliminate. Well, I think basically people are seeing, though, that the conflict hasn't been eliminated, but it's just been transferred to support issues and custody battles and things like that. So there is still a massive amount of conflict involved with divorces. But we are concerned about with the no-fault system is basically not several. One is it's really devalued the institution of marriage. I think when you look at all the agreements people can enter, why do we allow marriage to be one where one party can unilaterally break it without any consequences? And I've said to people it's easier to break a 30-year marriage than it is a $500 business agreement. And yet people rely on it, and it has enormous consequences for the community. Also, the impact on children, and I think that's the reason that children are in this bill. Children of divorce are 3 times more likely to be expelled from school or become pregnant, 5 times more likely to live in poverty, and 2 to 12 times more likely to be incarcerated. So the consequences are enormous for children in particular, as well as for adults. There was one study showing the social costs of marriage breakup and out-of-wedlock births, and the cost to the state of Minnesota, one conservative estimate was over $574 million a year in terms of the loss in taxes and judicial system and all those things. So it's enormous consequences. I believe this is a modest proposal to at least put a speed bump in the road, and as opposed to greasing the skids towards divorce. A couple interesting statistics. One is that 70% of divorces don't involve serious conflict, and 80% of divorces are filed against the will of their partner. So I think there's a lot of grounds there, issues in play there. And a study by the University of Chicago professor Linda Waite found that 86% of unhappily married people who stick it out find that in 5 years later their marriages are happier. So people go through difficult times, and I think the design or the goal of this bill is to at least help people to get through that, as opposed to the idea of difficulties come up, let's leave, let's bail out. I think it should be noted that there are 3 states which have 2-year waiting periods already in law, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Illinois, and there are 7 other states which have at least a year to 18 months waiting period, so this isn't unique. And they find that the divorce rate in those 3 states with a 2-year is half the rate of the 10 states with the highest divorce rates. So we just believe that this is important discussion to have to protect children, the interests of spouses, and fairness, justice, for the spouse that wants to keep the marriage together. I realize that you can't force somebody to be married, but I think for those cases where there is a chance, we should give that chance as much as we can. And I think this is an effort to at least put that in play. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Betzel.
Thank you. Mr. Pritchard, the law can set up the rules on how two people can get married, and the law can set up the rules under which how two people can end that marriage. But we don't do a very good job of telling two people how they should interact with each other during the marriage. I make the analogy to child support. We can order the non-custodial parent to pay child support, but we can't order the non-custodial parent to love a child. We can't order the non-custodial parent to be involved or, you know, in the day-to-day activities of the child. So there's a limit to what we can do in telling people how they're supposed to deal with other people. How does this solve that?
Well, Mr. Pritchard?
I guess my view of the law is it does shape people's attitudes and beliefs. And I think the state is very limited, like you've said, about going in there and basically being a therapist. It really can't. But I think if the law states that, hey, this is a significant decision you're entering and you don't just walk away from it, I think that plays a significant education role. And I think by going to the extreme of unilateral divorce, which I see no fault as, it's unilateral divorce, one person can end it, you're communicating a huge message. And I think at the very least the state should tilt the balance in favor of the spouse that wants to keep together, not to the place where you're forcing that spouse, the other spouse, to be married for the rest of their life, but at least say, hey, a couple years, you need to wait. And I think that will start to enter the public's mind that, hey, this is something we can't just walk away from. And, you know, I've been up around the legislature for over 20 years, astonishingly, and I look at so many of the issues you deal with at the legislature are dealing with the consequences of these breakups, whether it's custody, welfare, poverty, child support. And I'm just thinking, why don't we look at maybe dealing with things more on the front end about protecting those rights of the one spouse?
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard and Ms. McAllister. We have two other witnesses. I guess I didn't see the second one. Mr. Ditburner and Ms. Hugda. Oh. Ms. Hugda, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ditburner has graciously permitted me to go first. So my name is Melinda Hugdahl from the Legal Services Advocacy Project. I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill. And really, I kind of have kind of two areas I'm going to talk about. One is kind of the overarching issues, and then some of the mechanical issues that I think within the how the bill works pieces are either parts I'm not quite clear on or seem to be problematic in the actual application. I think as we've discussed really over time, there's been a lot of policy and legislative reform and movement to focus parents on the best interests of their children. And how they're going to parent over the long term after their divorce is finalized. Children, I think we all know, benefit from stability and the parties' ability to work together. And we believe that this bill does take a step away from that focus. That's where we think the focus of the parents should be. We're concerned that this may be detrimental to both parents and children, and I think, again, it's been mentioned in the committee. For parents, saying something in a public court hearing and then having testimony and evidence to prove it will significantly harden already hurt feelings, and those wounds are going to take much longer to heal. When those wounds happen, parents are less likely to be able to work together for the benefit of and co-parenting their children. Providing a basis of fault has far-reaching effects both inside and outside the family. For example, and we've talked some about adultery has been mentioned, proving adultery will almost certainly mean a public outing of the other party involved as well. This may dramatically impact two families in a very, very public way. Currently, these issues are not publicly aired, so the parties can choose to reveal or not reveal this information whichever way they deem appropriate. This bill removes those choices. Also, family court records and hearings are all public, so anyone can access even allegations of adultery, chemical dependency, and other issues, and that includes potentially the children of the parties. The fault ground for failure to follow through on an evaluation presumes, because it must be proven, that a person's mental or chemical health records, and as I understand it, perhaps gambling addiction records, should be public information and accessible to a spouse. To prove this ground, the party would have to introduce evidence showing the failure to follow through and would presumably have to introduce the underlying evaluation that hasn't been followed up on. We're also concerned from our experience that this will further encourage parties to manipulate not the other spouse but the party's children during a two-year waiting period. There doesn't seem to be a mechanism to really address those concerns or ways they happen. It's particularly true in situations of domestic abuse. Under current law, we see abusive spouses using custody and financial issues in the dissolution to further harass and manipulate the other spouse. We even had a case actually in legal services last week, one of my practitioners sent me, with an active order for protection, where the abusive spouse is dragging out litigation because he really wanted the spouse to publicly admit that the failed marriage was her fault. In that case, because fault's not an issue, when the judge talked to both counsel and chambers, he was able to say to them and to the parties that they needed to focus on resolution in the issues, and there was not going to be a public issue about who is at fault for the failure of the marriage. Under the terms of this bill, the abusive spouse could continue to manipulate and abuse over the course of that 2 years while the litigation is pending, even outside of litigation. But in the end, they would have to still look at the issue of fault, or try to force her to admit the failure of the marriage was her fault, or drop the divorce altogether. We have concerns regarding the significant resource expenditure this will require. Both parties will incur significant legal fees if they have to plead and litigate fault-related issues. In addition, the bill requires an additional hearing to invoke the stay of proceedings during the 2-year period, and that would certainly almost significantly extend the length of dissolution trials to prove the issues of fault as well. It seems that it's a significant amount of additional litigation of court resources, and at a time of dwindling resources, we're concerned about that issue. Moving into the other issue of some of the mechanics, the purpose of the 2-year waiting period, I understand from the testifier who started out of the issue of allowing parties to work on that issue, but if parties currently want to slow down the court process, they can do that. They can place a divorce on an active status. If they wish to try and work out their marriage and perhaps not have a final order, they can do that. So that's already provided for under the law. The 2-year wait begins by filing an answer or counterpetition. If one party wants to file divorce, they almost have to plead a fault divorce because at that point in time they don't know whether the other side will answer and thus start the 2-year clock. In other words, if there's an answer filed, you can't get relief on something you didn't plead in the first place. So if you don't plead it as fault and the other person does, you haven't asked for any basis of fault, so you'd have to reserve your petition for dissolution because you can't get relief on something you didn't ask for. But if the other person does answer, you've probably unnecessarily filed a fault divorce. If they do answer, then the 2-year wait starts. So it gets a little confusing on how things would have to plead, and we think it might actually encourage people to have to at least initially plead a fault divorce in order to preserve that claim, if you will, if that makes sense. The bill requires a finding by the court that the 2-year wait applies before all proceedings are stayed, but it also appears that the filing of the answer is what starts the 2-year clock. So we're not sure about the purpose of the hearing. It suggests the court has to make a finding to stay the court proceedings, which there has to be a hearing to have the finding of an order. So that is another piece where it's kind of unclear as to how the mechanics would work. It's unclear how the 2-year wait fits with the immediate finding of fault. In a temporary order, which the bill does provide for, typically those are issues that are kind of the interim issues. And the finding of fault really seems to be something that would be dealt with in a final stage of the proceeding in the divorce trial itself. So the only way those provisions seem to work together is if the parties somehow decide they want to settle in the interim and include a finding of fault. See, I mean, they have this temporary order that would go on, and they can't. The only way they can do anything before the end of the 2 years is essentially stipulate to fault, because the court wouldn't be determining fault probably as part of a temporary order. That would be part of a final dissolution trial. I think that's how it would work. The bill requires a stay of all proceedings except a hearing for a temporary order. And if things change or the temporary is violated, we don't see any provision in the bill for that to be heard. So in other words, if someone rings up a lot of debt, if someone's violating other terms of the order, it says that their only proceeding that's allowed is the hearing for a temporary order. So there's no accommodation for any enforcement. Presumably, unless, again, we got back into the issue of fault, they would have to wait out that 2 years.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hugdahl, good to see you here. A question for you. If we took out the fault portion and just had a waiting period, that would basically eliminate almost all of your concerns, wouldn't it?
Ms. Hugdahl?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, it would eliminate some of them, I think. I think that's fair. I think our concern with the waiting period is the standpoint that it's also connected with a stay of the proceedings. And for some folks, the longer the proceedings go on, the more the death issues continue to rise, those type of issues, and the opportunity to manipulate each other, and for the children involved too. Parties, in some cases, unfortunately, tend to look toward the final order stage. And so even though they have a temporary order for custody and parenting time, there's still that incentive to try and, you know, kind of put themselves in the best position.
Right. Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
But the complexity of the legal proceedings, those concerns would all be gone because we'd just be having a waiting period. And there might be some difficulty for the partners involved here during that waiting period, but the complexity of the legal proceedings that you talked about and the additional expense to the parties would not be a significant factor here.
Ms. Hogdahl?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I think to some extent that's true. I think of one issue in particular, and it's an issue that I think it's magnified with a waiting period, and that is, unfortunately, a lot of issues. Parties have debt that's being incurred. And under current law, I mean, because creditors, as you know, are not parties to the proceeding, they're not bound by the court's order, but they tend to kind of recognize, especially post-decree, because the parties are then divorced. But I think it makes things more complicated. Folks say, I know it's marital debt, but I have this temporary order from a while ago that said I'm not responsible. I think you may start to see it becoming harder to distinguish that in reality because there's no final order. See what I mean? The creditor saying, but you're still married.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman,
we have a similar concept in law. It's that redemption period with the foreclosure. The sale takes place, but it's not final until 6 months later. I would think we could do that same kind of legal construct here if we said, you know, the court hears the request, put a 1 year waiting period in place, and then either party could go back in and you know, withdraw the divorce. I think it could be workable here. But I agree about the fault, and I think that makes it incredibly complicated and costly. But I would hope that Senator Hand might consider some kind of an adjustment here to accomplish that. But I know you have other testifiers, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, taking out the exceptions makes it a simpler law, but it complicates things. As an example, domestic abuse. You take that out, now you're making the parties stay in a very violent relationship in some cases. For 2 years, you've got maybe a dad that, you know, beats up his wife, beats up his kids, and we're going to make them stay in there because there's no exception. That makes no sense either.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair, that wouldn't stop a judge from giving an order for protection if one were necessary. It wouldn't require anybody to live together. It just says that the divorce doesn't become final for a year.
But, Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, if you have that kind of a situation, and it's clear the parties should not be living together, why not let the divorce go through?
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I think the concept here is a cooling off period. I'm not sure that's such a bad idea, given all the concerns that we have as a society, for folks to take an extra look at this, not act or react the spur of the moment under very difficult circumstances, and maybe there is that opportunity for reconciliation. I don't think it's a bad idea for us as a state to try and encourage that.
Yes, Senator Ortman, I just I understand that. And I actually recognize, at first blush, I appreciated the simplicity of your suggestion. But then as I thought about it, I was just thinking that for somebody who is experiencing man or woman, who is experiencing a really bad relationship and who mustered up the courage to file for divorce and then to have a vindictive partner say, I don't consent to it. For us as policymakers to put into law to allow a court to say, yep, you, because of the protests, you have to stay. I'll give you an order for protection and all the other stuff, but you have to stay married to this person. I don't know. I mean, I'm concerned about that. I mean, I thought part of what we're trying to do is to empower people to feel like there's some relief, and I would hate to send that message to somebody who's in those circumstances, again, male or female, to say that somehow, even though they muster up the courage to go to a court, And the act itself might be inflammatory to this already really bad relationship, that then we also give the court the option, or we're telling them that they have to wait for a two-year period. I mean, let's think about that. Senator Orman?
Just to clarify, I was thinking it should only be a one-year waiting period and not a two-year, but...
Yep. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, it seems to me that the whole area of family law is always a difficult one because we're trying to use the laws to put a structure in place to fix a situation that sometimes goes beyond the law's ability to deal with it. No, and so we have the ideal of what we'd like to see for children and for people in general, but people don't always act according to that ideal. And so there's never really a great solution in the law, and we've looked at this over a long period of time and what's better, you know, and what's better for kids. You have statistics, and I don't doubt that divorce is hard for kids. Don't doubt that at all. But it's also really hard for kids to be in really dysfunctional or abusive relationships and being abused and be exposed to that every day. And it's hard to separate out those statistics because, you know, where you have divorce, you have some of that going on. So was it the dysfunction and abuse that caused the problem, or was it the divorce that caused the problem? You know, it's not most of these studies don't look more deeply at some of those issues. Would kids be better off having to deal with the divorce dysfunction, or would they be better off having to deal with the dysfunction of being forced to stay in an abusive situation? You know, the first time a child is killed by an abuser because they're waiting for this one-year waiting period to expire, you know, then we'll come back and look at that individual situation and say, this is horrible. You know, so I guess my point, Senator Hand, is just that there's no way for us to find a way for the law to fix all of these situations. But I remain convinced that the way that we can minimize conflict, that that's the overriding best way to go.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the discussion of the members. It's always thoughtful, and I appreciate the attention brought to this. And my intention, as Senator Betzold pointed out, was to permit, under some circumstances where it was clearly in the best interest of children, to permit the divorce, but also to try to build a bias into the structure to say families with minor children ought to stay together or ought to at least have some waiting period before a divorce becomes final. And my own judgment, and there are studies, and I guess we can bring differing studies, but I think it's fairly conclusive that we have experienced a much higher degree of magnitude of divorce in the last 40 years since we have gone to a no-fault structure, not only in Minnesota but across the country. I have not been persuaded that that has led to better, more stable conditions for children. And so part of my point here is to try to get us to rethink this idea of complete no-fault divorce, and rather than say, well, we shouldn't have it at all, I thought there might be some room that we could come to agreement on and say, when you have minor children, is there a way to put some impediment into this unilateral divorce that can happen today if one party just decides they're done? And I know personally people who have gone that route, and it's tragic. And it seems to me that if there's a way to say, let's put something in place so that there is a period of time where the two people can recognize that what they're doing is going to have huge repercussions for their kids and give them an opportunity to work together. And maybe some of the things that were talked about in the previous bill are a part of that thought. But it's not my intention here to say, well, let's make every divorce a fault-based divorce. But let's say when you're dealing with minor children under certain circumstances, let's put a cooling-off period in place unless there is an egregious reason to allow the divorce to go ahead immediately. That's my intent. That's my hope. If the language that we've written doesn't comply with all the process issues that are being brought forward, I frankly was not aware of all those things until earlier today, and I'm not faulting the other side for not bringing them forth sooner, but my belief is those things can be dealt with if need be. To me, the important question is whether or not we as a state are going to create a bias in favor of a marriage or whether we're going to continue to have a bias in favor of unilateral dissolution, especially when there are minor children involved.
You know, Sanahan, I think that it's not an issue of bias. I think that the solution that you're putting forth could be had maybe in a different way. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to kind of pause a little bit, and perhaps one of the, as I was sitting here thinking, is that what gets messy is the solution that you're proposing, that we as a legislative body is contemplating. It's messy because it's embedded in a process, you know, that involves kind of things going back and forth. If your triggering mechanism is that there are minor children involved in something that's about to unravel, is there a mechanism at the point when somebody is contemplating filing the divorce papers before the papers get served, but that, you know, whether it's through a lawyer or on their own, in order to file the divorce papers with the courts, is there something that could be done? And I think this is what Senator Dill's other bill was trying to do, was to say, unless you've got domestic circumstances or other circumstances, you know, that would allow you to go forward, if there are minor children involved, can we detour you at before you even serve the paper? Therefore, getting into this process is very messy. Can we create opportunities and sort of refer you to an alternative? I wonder if that isn't a better way to do it, because I think the current system, I hear what you're saying, is that you agree with all of us about wanting to protect people who are vulnerable, and that's why they want to get out of the situation. But I'm wondering if there is a step before you get to even the filing of the paperwork that we can capture people and sort of refer them. So think about that. I think people on the committee would be willing to work with you, and that I'm interested in that. And I think Senator Dill's bill would have been an interesting approach. But I think there are cost implications to that, and I think that's why he pulled the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, in the Judiciary Budget Division, just in the last committee hearing time, we heard from the courts about their financial situation and how they are going to deal with the proposed budget cuts. And Judge Knutson, Judge Meslow, both members of the legislature before they went off to be judges, pointed out that it is likely, because of the courts being in such dire straits, that what may have been a hearing time that might have been 6 weeks out ordinarily will now be 9 months or more. Last year, we may have actually even seen that in this committee from the Chief Justice, his plan, if the budget cuts get worse and worse, the items that the courts do, he kind of put them on a high, medium, and low priority. Divorce was in medium, so it's likely that, you know, the two-year waiting period may actually happen just because our state's in such bad financial shape.
Mm. Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, there's always a silver lining, isn't there?
She's such an optimist. Call me a cockeyed optimist.
Yeah. I happen to be very intrigued with Senator Hand's bill. And certainly knowing friends that have gone through similar divorces is what were described. I'm not sure, but maybe if there was a cooling off period, there would have been a different outcome. Now, there are complications, and I think that, Senator Hand, you're going in an area, the Minnesota family law is a place where angels do not tread. And I think the advocacy attorneys that advocate for their clients have recognized this kind of a balance of, it's like a game like when we were kids, a pickup stick game. And you get all these elements all mashed in a confused pile of sticks, and if you happen to draw one stick out to uncomplicated, everyone that's playing the game says foul. And I think in order for us to perhaps look out for the best interests of children and hope that there might be a stability that can be preserved in this relationship, I think you're going in the right direction. Now, I'm not an expert in family law, and even though I'm a ranking member here, it's one area that I fear to go. And I know Senator Neville, when he was proposing changes and reform to the Minnesota family law, it took him about 4 years to balance the all of the parties' interests in bringing some of his reform in. So it's a noble task, and I compliment you for bringing this bill forward. I like the direction that you've started. And I think I would, if I were you, I would welcome the suggestion of the chair to continue working on it and working with the various advocates and the interested, and the attorneys certainly that are expert in it. You probably run into a lot more resistance than you do in finding reform-minded individuals. But I do like the direction you're going, and I wish you the best of luck.
And Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, thank you for that, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your suggestion. My interest is, of course, to find a way that, and I do recognize, being a former member of the Judiciary Committee at the time when Senator Neville at that time was working on those things, how complex and how difficult these changes are. So I am willing to do anything that is practical in trying to move us forward in this direction to recognize what I believe to be the importance of having children stay a part of a family, if possible. And I also know, as a married person, that there are periods of time when married couples have difficulties. And sometimes the passions that we have lead us to do things that aren't always in our best interest, although we may be driven to do them anyway. So if there are ways, and if this is not the right exact mechanism, I am more than willing to, whatever the process is, laid on the table or set it aside or whatever that is, to continue to work on it. But I would be very much interested in seeing if we can make some progress this year to do something to put the state on record of saying we want families with minor children to do something more than just head for divorce court when there's a conflict.
Well, Senator Hahn, I think that the fact that this chair wants to hear these bills should send the signal to people that children are important and they matter. And as grown-ups, we need to do everything that we can because we have that responsibility and the obligation to make sure that we take care of our children, whether that's within the confines of a family, in a marriage, or as single people. We ultimately have that responsibility, and you and I have done that work together, and I care very much about that. And that's why we're hearing these bills, because I think that it's important to have these hearings so that we could send the message to the public that these topics are important to us. I'm hearing the conversation from the members in the committee, and so we're going to lay your bill on the table. And it is because I think that by leaving it here, you have advanced the issue, and we have had an opportunity to talk about it. Plus, it does let people know that it is important for us to think about that. And whether that is through Senator Dill's mechanism, other bills that are out there, or through your proposal, I think that it's something that's worthwhile for all of us to be thinking about. So thank you for putting this bill in front of us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I appreciate
Senator Ortman?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I'm wondering if you are interested at all in maybe taking out that concept of fault as the committee has discussed, and then maybe making this a cooling off period instead, just so that when you work through this concept, it doesn't raise all those concerns again, that it's not workable because it's got the fault provisions built in again. And that's completely up to you. I won't offer it unless you think that's a good idea, but it would be my recommendation to you that you do that before it gets laid on the table so everyone can see that important change has been made.
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I appreciate that, but I'm also very sensitive to the comments that Senator Betzold made about if you do have an egregious circumstance, do you want to compel that marriage to stay intact? And I'm not quite sure how to sort that out. And so I guess for now, I think it would be best, let's just lay it on the table. I'd be happy to work with you or others to see how we can craft something that would satisfy those concerns. My hope is that we could do something to move this forward a little bit, and whatever we can do to do that, I'm willing to entertain. So I'm not here by any means saying take it or leave it, but I am willing and wishing to work with you all to find a good solution. So thank you for the opportunity to have a hearing this afternoon.
Well, Senator Ortman is very thoughtful, and sometimes she reminds me a little bit of Senator Neville in that she likes to draft and think things through in committee. So certainly take full advantage of her when she is willing to give you good ideas. All right. Well, you have one more bill that we're going to look at. Senate filed 2362.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Yes, we have a second bill, Senate File 2362, which I'm sure will be much less complicated and controversial than what we just heard on. And I'm sure we'll be
tongue
able
in
to
cheek.
Very expeditiously move right through this. And
we'll be the judges.
I know you will, Senator. And Madam Chair, let me just say that this was a bill that I introduced at the request. Actually, I heard from a couple of constituents that had similar circumstances. I found it kind of ironic that I heard from more than one person who said, here's a circumstance. Can't we do something about this? And so I asked for some language to be drafted to try to accommodate that concern. And I want to recognize that one of the people that contacted me is here today is Mr. Tim Dennis, and he has brought along, I think, an attorney that he has worked with on this issue in his own case. But basically, the idea is very simple, is to put in place, in addition to the conditions that exist for in current law to set aside the obligation to pay spousal maintenance, there would be an additional condition which would allow for cohabitation to be a reason for that spousal maintenance commitment to be set aside. And so it's a simple bill to read. It probably raises complex issues, if I judge from the last bill that we had. But I would like to offer Mr. Dennis and or his attorney, Sue Wilson, a chance to comment if they would be interested to do so.
Who would like to go first, Mr. Dennis or Ms. Wilson?
I'll go first, Madam.
Ms. Wilson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is M. Sue Wilson. I'm an attorney. I practice in Minnetonka. I became licensed in Minnesota the year that no-fault divorce came in, 1975. I have been practicing in family law since that date. And over the years, the initial years of my practice, spousal maintenance was almost impossible to obtain for women. And I have horror stories of women who were limited to 4 years of maintenance. There was a case called Otis that basically said you get 4 years and that's it. The world changed for dependent spouses in 1987 with a decision by Justice Coyne in the Nardini case. And that case was later codified in Minnesota Statutes 518-552, which is the spousal maintenance statute. And what that case stands for is the principle that if there's any uncertainty that the dependent spouse is going to become self-supporting, that permanent maintenance is to be ordered. And that became the law of Minnesota for permanent maintenance. Until then, we really didn't have it. What has happened since that date is that there are a lot of women who were then granted permanent maintenance after 1987. And many cases have come up years and years later. I had a case 2 years ago that's really prompted this. It wasn't that I represented Mr. Dennis. It's that he read the decision and contacted me, where the Minnesota courts are determining that the current statute 518A.39, which is the modification statute, that the courts are saying that they really cannot modify spousal maintenance or eliminate it if there is what was called a meretricious relationship, which is a cohabitation. Even though we have cases that say, yes, you can modify if there's a financial benefit to the party receiving maintenance, the courts have said repeatedly that they aren't going to do it. And the last case was this case of Nelson v. Voigt, where they said go to the legislature. And in our research in doing the briefs in that case, I found a case where Judge Short of the Court of Appeals said that the current law promotes fraud and discourages remarriage, and perhaps the legislature should reexamine the law. And so that's why I'm here. What happens is that in the case of Nelson v. Voigt, in 1994, the parties were divorced. The reason for the divorce was Ms. Voigt had become involved with someone else. She has now lived with him since then, And I deposed them, both she and her partner, and they both said, oh, we're in a permanent relationship. We're in this for life. We've exchanged rings. Our families are one. We're totally in a committed relationship. And I said, why aren't you married? And they both said, we don't want to lose the spousal maintenance. So what's happened is that Mr. Nelson now is supporting that household. And I, you know, put in evidence that there's a financial benefit of like $900 a month that she's getting by having her new partner split all the expenses. But the court still said, no, that's not a basis for modification. I researched this issue and found that many other states, even states in this upper Midwest region, have statutes which have cohabitation as a factor which would eliminate spousal maintenance, just as remarriage or death of either the payor or the payee would eliminate it. Those states that have specific statutory language include Alabama, California, Georgia, New York, and Illinois. And there's Iowa has really specific case law on what is required to eliminate a spousal maintenance based on cohabitation. And it's been defined in a statute as unrelated person of opposite sex living in the dwelling of the former spouse. Illinois' statute says, if the party receiving spousal maintenance cohabits with another person on a resident continuing conjugal basis. So essentially, it's living together as husband and wife. And I think that what I've experienced, and I'm a big advocate of spousal maintenance, is I think spousal maintenance in these long-term marriages is at risk because people have first, two things have happened. One is that there's no longer the stigma on living together out of wedlock. So many of the people that I'm seeing doing this are, you know, very nice Lutheran church ladies, you know, who are otherwise, you know, 20 years ago I don't think would have done this, but now there's no stigma. And then the second thing that's changed is that I think it's just become common knowledge that you can game the system by living together without marriage. You can write wills. You can do powers of attorney, you know, beneficiaries of life insurance, 401ks, that kind of thing. So there are so many people that are married in all but name only, and there you have this guy over here, the ex-husband, for, in this case, now 16 years, paying money to somebody who is essentially being supported in a sense. I mean, there is money going to her. There's also joint expenses being paid. But he cannot get out of the spousal maintenance obligation without this language because the courts are not wanting to do it. I can tell you that I know of, there are several cases where the courts have said, even though there's cohabitation, even though we know there's economic interdependence because that just happens, that nonetheless we're not going to allow the spousal maintenance obligation to be lifted. And I believe that, as Judge Short said, it does promote fraud. It promotes the fraud of doing everything but get married so that you don't have to lose your maintenance. And it also discourages marriage. I mean, if it weren't, my belief is that if this bill were passed, that there would be a lot of wedding bells ringing that aren't ringing now if the cohabitation bill were passed. So the argument against it, and I've heard this over and over, and it's discussed in all the cases, is the partner, the new partner of the dependent spouse doesn't have, what if he leaves? What if he walks away the next day after the court has eliminated spousal maintenance? And in a case where the parties have both stated we're in a permanent long-term relationship and have a lifetime commitment, I don't think that's a risk. In other cases, the court could reserve. We reserve maintenance all the time. And if we reserve maintenance in those circumstances, then there's at least economic justice for the payor who is not supporting the new household, paying for, in this one case, I think, the remodeling of the garage. I mean, the extra money is just used to up the standard of living of the dependent spouse and her new partner, which is not the purpose of spousal maintenance. So that's why I'm here as an advocate of spousal maintenance, asking that we preserve it by not letting people misuse it in a way which defeats the purpose.
And then Mr. Dennis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here pretty much to echo what Sue just said.
Then can you echo as briefly as you can? we have two. I'm so sorry. We have two other bills that we need to get to, but this is important to Senator Hand, so we wanted to give a chance to have a discussion on it.
Yes, Madam Chair. My divorce was effective in 2004. By that decree, I was ordered to pay her permanent spousal maintenance of, until I died or retired or she remarried. Minnesota judges need a law that will allow them to terminate spousal maintenance when the former spouse is cohabiting with a new partner in a domestic relationship. In my case, my ex and her partner have done all they can to live as a married couple without actually marrying, such as he moved his belongings from his Wisconsin home into her townhouse and has lived there since 2006. He receives his mail at her address. He shares and pays her bills. They attend each other's family functions together. I have seen through discovery that they have joint credit cards. She is in his will. In October of 2007, she quit her full-time job. I have requested that the court to stop spousal maintenance because of cohabitation. It seems my judge could not terminate spousal maintenance in this case without a law allowing him to do so. So I ask that you vote in favor of this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have three other. Do you want to ask your questions now, or can you hold off until? Okay, thanks. We have three other people who would like to testify on this. Can I have you all come up together? And then we'll just go boom, boom, boom if you all want to testify. Ms. Wagner, oh, Mr. Dipburner, if you're here, I'm sorry, I forgot about you in the last one. And then Ms. Hugdahl. Sorry, I apologize.
Did you want to comment on it?
If you can all help me be succinct and not overlap, that would be very helpful. Thank you. Mr. Dipburner, you get to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Michael Dipburner. I'm an attorney in private practice in the southwestern suburbs of Hennepin County. I'm a former chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and I'm also involved in the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. And basically, I'm just giving you my own testimony. I'm not representing any organization's views. Right now in the area of cohabitation and spousal maintenance, there needs to be some kind of economic component to the cohabitation in order for the cohabitation to impact whether or not maintenance should be reduced or kept the same. And a court who fails to consider the economic impact of cohabitation, if it's been raised, would have its order reversed and remanded back down to it. That's basically what the law is. In addition, people have the ability, when they're going through a divorce proceeding, to stipulate that maintenance could terminate upon cohabitation. It's just that a court does not have the authority to issue such an order over the objection of one of the parties. There are a lot of cases that deal with the issue of cohabitation and its impact upon an award of spousal maintenance, and they all deal with this issue of economics. And in preparation for my testimony today, I actually looked at a few of the cases, and the Nelson case was actually one of them. And my understanding of what the district court did in that case is that it performed a detailed analysis of the economic impact in that situation, looked at the wife's income, her expenses, the contribution of her partner, along with the husband's income and expenses, and concluded that there was still a shortfall at the end of the day of just several hundred dollars per month, but allowed the maintenance to continue in that case. And that's the type of analysis that is basically engaged in, that has been engaged in for the past 35 years or so since the leading cases on this issue were handed down by the Minnesota Supreme Court. If we're to go ahead and change the law, I see that this bill really only applies to situations in which you have unrelated people of opposite genders. You can have people of the same sex cohabitate who can be involved in a committed relationship. For some reason, though, this legislation allows that type of cohabitation not to have to result in a termination of spousal maintenance. And spousal maintenance, the termination, it's complete. You can't go back and change it later if wedding bells didn't ring and the people that were cohabitating decided not to get married but ended their relationship. In that type of situation, the person that was in need of spousal maintenance no longer will have that option available to them. And spousal maintenance, at the end of the day, it really is just simply based upon need. and the other party's ability to pay. That's nothing more, nothing less. So I speak in opposition to this legislation.
Thank you. Ms. Wagoner.
Thank you. My name is Pamela Wagoner, and I am the chair of the Family Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. The section did consider this bill again at its meeting on Saturday this past week and voted in opposition to it. The primary concerns included Mr. Ditburner's points that were considered. In addition, the section felt that it's very important to understand that spouses can bargain for both the amount and duration of spousal maintenance as they bargain for the distribution of marital and non-marital property. This bill does not treat obligor spouses and obligee spouses, the payor of spousal maintenance and the payee of spousal maintenance, equally. If it did, the obligee spouse would also retain the right to seek an increase in spousal maintenance based on the cohabitation of the obligor spouse. But that is not in this bill. This says just only that the termination of spousal maintenance will occur on the cohabitation of the obligee spouse. In addition, this enactment of this kind of bill will encourage unwarranted interference and potentially actionable harassment in the lives of former spouses by the hiring of private eyes, by trying to go through trash and figuring out, okay, exactly what kind of relationship is this cohabitant. Cohabitation is not defined in this law. We don't know what is meant by cohabitation here. Many times people, as a result of the economic devastation of divorce, will seek to have someone living in the house with them. Does that mean they are sharing all expenses? Absolutely not. It can mean, yes, that there is an economic impact for receipt, for example, of part of the house payment or part of the apartment. But again, that can be addressed in modifications where you look at the economic impact of the cohabitant. And again, the family law section did vote to oppose it for those reasons as well as those reasons enunciated by Mr. Ditburner. Thank you.
Ms. Hogdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Melinda Hogdahl with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. I won't repeat in the interest of time the points made by Mr. Ditburner and Ms. Wagoner. We've had similar conversations within the legal aid community. But in addition, again, talking about the definition of cohabitation is not in the statute, no standard of how it would be proven, and no connection to a financial benefit to the obligee spouse. But there is one also additional piece of information that's interesting and where it fits in the statute currently. Currently, it's death and remarriage and spousal maintenance. And this is a different animal in several respects. One of them is when the spousal maintenance is set to terminate, you don't really need to litigate those issues. Not to be too blunt about it, but either the other spouse is dead or they're not. So cohabiting or not is a much broader question. And so it is, I think, from the aspect of looking at opening the door to probably some significant litigation on what the word cohabiting means in Minnesota. Some of that may be in existing case law, but when it becomes statutory, it may take a slightly different bent. And also one big aspect for our community is spousal maintenance. The termination of it is permanent. And so even if circumstances do change, that person is not able to come back. And the termination, really the way the statute is raised and currently written, the cohabitation is a single factor. And we feel really if they're looking at modification, the entirety of the situation of both parties should be considered and not just one single factor of cohabitation being something that in and of itself could come in and permanently end spousal maintenance.
Senator Olson, thank you, all three of you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Han, I was thinking about your bill and actually discussing it with someone earlier today. And I was thinking, you know, I'm not unsympathetic to the situation where because of a divorce, say both parties are barely making it or in financial constraints, and the judges looked real carefully at the time of the divorce in kind of trying to balance what's available to support both parties post-divorce, and based on the needs of the parties and the assets available and the earning potential or whatever, comes to a decision. And if there's a circumstance that significantly alters that equation, that it probably isn't fair that one person should have to be in a worse financial position where the other one's financial position is significantly elevated, and that could go in either direction. So I'm not unsympathetic to that, and so at first blush, I wanted to think about your bill and whether that made sense. But it also immediately occurred to me that the situation could go the other way, and I think someone alluded to that here today, where the person who's making the payments, you know, there might have been a limited amount of money to go around that person had to make those payments, and so they could only afford to pay X in terms of maintenance. But now they might begin to cohabitate with someone else and have the ability to pay more towards spousal maintenance. And there's nothing in your bill that balances the scales in that direction. It only kind of balances them in one direction. And then I was also, you know, some of these other issues that have been raised today I hadn't really even thought about, but I think there is some legitimacy to those concerns as well. And another question I had was in the states that do allow, that do look at cohabitation, some other states I know recognize common law marriage responsibilities, and we don't. And so if you were to end something because of a common, long cohabitation, maybe that person is going to have some responsibilities to the other person because of the common law marriage law in that state that might be different than ours. Maybe we shouldn't end maintenance permanently if we want to continue to look at some of these fairness issues so that these things could be revisited. You know, I don't know the answers to all these questions. This isn't my area of specialty, but I certainly have a lot of questions raised by your bill, and I'm not prepared to make a decision that would make it this sweeping change without having a lot more answers to those questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Olson, I appreciate your comments. And let me make a couple of observations on this. And I certainly respect, I'm not an attorney. We've got attorneys here that are learned in the law. And they certainly have a theoretical case that they have made. But there is no one here, either in person or representing a person, who is a cohabiting ex-spouse that is benefiting from this, that is testifying against this bill. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me is significant. And maybe it would be interesting to solicit and see if there are people who would say, well, I am a ex-spouse and I'm now cohabitating or living with somebody else, and if this law were to pass, it would be detrimental, and here's why. That might be interesting to find out if there is such a person. My point is that there seems to be an aggrievement here that is one-sided, which is the person who is paying the spousal maintenance, and as the testimony of Ms. Wilson indicates, that it is a structure that is fairly easy to, in her terms, game, and allow a financial benefit to occur that probably shouldn't occur. Yeah. Now, there is that mirror circumstance, Senator Olson, that you mentioned and one of the attorneys mentioned as well. I don't know if that's different than if a person who is divorced has a job promotion or changes jobs and makes more money. Does that change the spousal maintenance structure? I don't think it does, and so I'm not sure if there is a mirror image. But maybe there is, and if that's the case, then I'd be willing to contemplate doing something to address that as well. But my point is that I think that the circumstances were brought to me and by more than one person and seem to suggest that there should be some remedy to permit a judgment to be altered or changed or set aside in the case where an ex-spouse is clearly not in financial need, or at least not in significant financial need as they were at one time, but still requiring the ex-spouse to make those payments. I think there's a fairness here that needs to be addressed.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I spent more than 10 years in family law work, and I've seen the goods and the bad, and needless to say, you frequently find that when there are divorce, why that they have so much money and properties and so forth, generally not enough to do more than just get by. So then the divorce happens and the party left and you end up with a situation where they don't have enough money, so they can't do their child support, or if they do give it, it isn't adequate to provide the need in the case. There's a whole series of implications of that. The case law is just dancing around in there. And I'll tell you, there's no easy answer. You can put down what you have done here, and it's the enforcement of that. There's just really not a way to take that. You get animosity and anger at one another. One of the common things is to quit work. You get an electrician or a plumber or something like that. Body shop is great for those. They'll quit paying altogether and so on. And the collection on that is pretty hard. Some of them found out even there that it was pretty good to take that because you wouldn't end up paying in the future there. So I'm really interested in seeing where this would go, but I don't think there's any magic in the child support area, and so I'll leave it at that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Senator Foley. This doesn't do anything with respect to child support other than it may have a positive effect. If you have an ex-spouse who is doing both child support and spousal maintenance, and the ex-spouse is living in a home where there is additional financial resources coming in to support that spouse, the diminishing of the spousal maintenance may, in fact, make it more likely that the child support portion would be paid. And I just offer that as a theoretical, a hypothetical circumstance that may, in fact, be advantageous if the child support is a problem. But I don't know any facts on that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Hunt. Essentially, that's true. But with the way the law has been developed and how that goes, I would think that you ought to look at what can be done with that. There's more in different directions than we have. I just don't think that this is going to, you know, be any magic thing. Unfortunately, that's a common thing, is to complain about the spousal maintenance and child support aspects of that. And so if you can get that, that'd be a great. The other part that goes with it regarding visitation and dissolution of the property are got to be tied in with that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just felt the need to respond to what you said, Senator Hahn, because it made me wonder about the real motivation for this bill. I mean, if we have maintenance because it's about the needs and the costs and the ability to pay, then it seems to me that kind of the old adage, what's good for the goose is good for the gander and vice versa, ought to apply in terms of the comment I made about looking at this in both directions. And if there's a problem with doing that, then it seems to me like it becomes more about just, you know, I don't want to pay anymore when that person's, my ex-spouse is with somebody else. And I don't think that's a proper motivation. Because if we're looking at costs, you know, it might be that when a person's cohabitating, they've increased their expenses. We don't know that. You know, it could be that other person they're cohabitating with isn't working, and they're helping to share some of their expenses. I mean, you wouldn't know that without getting in and finding out what the real financial picture is, and making this an automatic doesn't allow for that. It then seems more geared toward just, you know, we don't want to pay anymore if there's somebody else in the household, and I don't think that's a proper reason.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Olson, I thank you for that. But I guess the same circumstance could be raised if someone remarries and they remarry into a lower economic circumstance. Do they still have a spousal obligation after they remarried? And clearly they do not. But I guess that there is, to me, some justice if you are married and you are sharing income and resources and then you divorce, I can understand there's an expectation that there ought to be continued sharing of those resources. But once a person who has been divorced goes into another relationship, marriage or, in this case, a permanent relationship other than marriage, I think it is fair to say there should not be that continued obligation on the part of the ex-spouse to support that person. And I don't know if your point about the going the other way, this doesn't speak to whether or not the person getting the support is male or female. I think it works either way. It's neutral as far as gender or which spouse. But I do think that there is a question to say if you are leaving a marriage for another relationship, should that spousal maintenance continue? And I think that's the question that's being raised. We clearly say it's not if it's a remarriage. The real question is if it's a permanent cohabiting relationship, should that at least be considered as the same circumstance as a marriage?
To the lawyers at the table, even though spousal maintenance has been granted in a dissolution, there's always the opportunity to petition to change that. Is that correct?
Yes.
Ms. Wagner?
Madam Chair, yes. You can make a motion to modify spousal maintenance when it's permanent. And a part of that as well is that people can agree and stipulate to the duration as well as the amount. So you have temporary spousal maintenance and permanent spousal maintenance. We have a case law of the Karen waiver where people can bargain to a point where they can make spousal maintenance stop. And they can also agree that upon cohabitation, they can, if they stipulate to it, they can make provisions in their agreement and bargain for the fact of cohabitation without this.
Madam Chair,
Senator Hand.
And to that point, and I understand that if you stipulate as part of a divorce the circumstances, that's not problematic. But we did hear testimony from Ms. Wilson that if that hasn't been done, even if there is cohabitation, even if there is established financial benefit, it doesn't seem to be effective. And as she testified to, the court would say, well, unless the legislature acts, that this cannot be a consideration in dealing with spousal maintenance.
Senator Hand, though, wouldn't you be the circumstances under which and the rationale in Mr. Dennis's example is certainly one that makes us all sympathetic. But just as there's his example out there in the real world, aren't there also some real examples where once somebody is in a permanent relationship, they do say, I will give up spousal maintenance to do that? I mean, I think there's the possibility that exists. And certainly, isn't there also the possibility that a supporting spouse could be petitioning for a change of circumstances on the basis that this other spouse is with somebody else when, in fact, it's not true? I mean, so the spectrum of cases that are out there, I mean, ranges through those different extremes. And so I don't want the record purely only to reflect, because you said, you know, there's nobody here saying that I'm cohabitating someone else and I'm fighting for the alimony. I think the people who will be here might very well be somebody who said, you know what, I was living with a roommate who happens to be of the opposite sex or whatever, and my spouse and took me to court and tried to deprive me of this, and in fact some terrible judge did deprive me of alimony, and I think that if we spend enough time, I think there would be people who could come forward to show that the system didn't work for them even though they didn't game the system. And so I just didn't want us to leave this discussion thinking that somehow if for those of us who might not agree with where the direction that the bill you're going, that somehow we are then for people to game the system if we philosophically disagree with the direction of the bill. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sitting here trying to understand where spousal maintenance ever came from. And the question I wanted to raise is if spousal maintenance is somewhat a product of some type of family law evolution. Yeah. Was it created as a means to perhaps incentivize an agreement prior to the no-fault divorce laws that we have now? Was it originally created to incentivize a signature for divorce, or could it be a product of perhaps more rooted in damages, either real or punitive? Where is the history of spousal maintenance, and how did it come about? It seems like I'm guessing maybe in an earlier time when the husband was historically the main breadwinner in a family, spousal maintenance might have meant something much far different than what it may mean today in a time when you have a family that may have two professionals, both husband and wife, and that perhaps spousal maintenance may not have the same impact as what it once did. And I was wondering if any of these attorneys in the room might be able to give us a little degree of knowledge of how has it come about? What does it mean in today's world versus where it may have been some other time? Because I think that may have a bearing on where the state might go in the future.
Well, I think Senator Limmer has to answer his own question, but Ms. Hogdahl, very quickly.
I'm going to try a very quick answer. I know Mr. Dipperner may want to add to that, but essentially, in fact, last night I spent a fair amount of time with the old statutes about spousal maintenance. And really, I think if you look back historically, it really was looking at when the parties are involved in a marriage, the shared responsibility of increased and diminished earning capacities and how the function of that relationship works. And certainly that's, I think, one context of that is a perhaps working and maybe a homemaker spouse. Over time, I think there's still differences in earning capacity and decisions to perhaps come out of the workplace for a period of time for one spouse or the other. So that really was one significant factor in spousal maintenance, was looking at it from the aspect of trying to have when the marriage dissolves, having a shared responsibility by both spouses, that there may have been increased and a decreased future earning capacity. And so spousal maintenance was one way to try to kind of equalize that shared kind of responsibility. I think Senator Olson said very well, in a lot of cases, it's the court trying to nobly meet that goal with very limited resources. But that's, I think, my simple explanation about that.
Senator Hahn, and then we're going to vote.
Okay,
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to recall the testimony of Ms. Wilson on this issue, where she indicated that it was originally set up to be a limited period of time that spousal maintenance was in effect, and it became a permanent obligation, I think she said, in 1986. So the current structure that we have is relatively new in that sense. And I appreciate your attention and your willingness to hear this issue and certainly the other issue as well. I don't know what the expectation is here if you're trying to assemble bills to include in a larger bill. If so, I would then certainly move that it be set on the table for that consideration, or if you want to take it separately just to move it forward, whichever direction.
We usually send bills out of here or vote on bills individually, and then if at some point we decide to assemble a larger bill, then we'll take the bills that have passed through committee and bring them back for reconsideration. So, Senator Limmer, do you want to move?
I'll move Senate File 2362, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 2362 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Madam Chair, thank you for your attention and your consideration of the bills, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. Thank you. Members, we have two bills, the Cadmium Jewelry Ban Bill, the Cadmium Jewelry Ban Bill, and then the Revisers Bill, both of which shouldn't take very long, I don't think. So we got started a little bit late. I'm going to ask you to hang in there with me because we should fly by these two fairly quickly. Senator Higgins, Senate File 2385.
Madam Chair, I believe I have an A2 amendment. And this is actually the piece that would have brought this bill to the Judiciary Committee. So in the last committee, we did a delete all amendment, and this kind of got missed. So So I would like to move the A2 amendment, which actually puts in the enforcement by the Attorney General.
Okay. And since this is not the first committee, Senator Higgins, why don't you just walk us through the bill and then talk about the amendment and we'll vote on it.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, this is a bill to regulate the amount of cadmium in children's jewelry. In January of this year, the Associated Press released a report that cadmium is appearing in children's jewelry, especially imported items. Cadmium is a carcinogen, and it has been shown to cause developmental problems in small children. It actually affects the brain much more damaging way than lead does. Cadmium does not have to be ingested for exposure. Children can suck on an item or bite into an item to be exposed. In 2007, after a tragic death of a young child from lead poisoning, we passed here in the legislature a bill to ban lead from children's toys and jewelry. Senator Klobuchar then authored a similar bill in the United States Senate, and that also passed. Both bills were supported very bipartisanly. And I'm putting forth this legislation back here at the state so that we can ensure that the necklaces, bracelets, and toys that our littlest Minnesotans play with are safe. Before the hearing in the last committee, I met with a whole room full of people from the industry. There is federal legislation that regulates cadmium in children's toys, and you will see in the bill references to the ASTM International Safety Specification on Toy Safety, and then a number. That is the regulation of cadmium. What we are doing in this bill is making the same regulation, the same amount, also for children's jewelry, charms, that kind of thing. And then, like we put in the lead bill, paragraph B, starting on line 19 of page 1, gives an out for organizations like Goodwill Industries and places where something may have been given to them or donated to them, and it does not put them in danger of an action against them if they inadvertently give it away or sell it.
And the A2 amendment?
And the A2 amendment gives the enforcement to the Attorney General. So I would move the A2 amendment.
Any discussions on the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer?
Under enforcement, is there action for a private action to be filed by a private citizen in addition to the Attorney General being involved?
I'm going to punt that to
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, Senator Lemmer, there is a private action under Section 8.31, but that's kind of been the discussion of, I think, some other bills in recent years because the courts have construed that somewhat narrowly and have only allowed a private action in a case where it can be shown to be in the broader public interest. So this doesn't specifically pick that up.
Madam Chair, we've had these discussions before, and I'm always a little leery of creating any type of prohibition or barring a private citizen from filing an action, even though the Attorney General may, or we would want to recognize an Attorney General's opportunity to enforce this section, but I always believe that a private citizen should have a right to pursue action if they were harmed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
In my folder, and I assume it was in your packets as well, there is a copy of 8.31, and on the third page of that, subdivision 3A talks about private remedies, saying that any person injured by a violation of the laws referred to may bring a civil action and recover damages. So I think you're covered, unless I misunderstand it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Counsel, you believe that perhaps under 8.31, at least the private remedy, that courts have been very narrow in the definition of that. Could you, is there a way to maybe tell me what narrow means in your?
Senator Lamont, I have a big file on it back in my office. I think they've required that there be something more than just an individual violation, but that has to be shown. The private action has to be shown kind of in the public interest in a broader sense.
Okay.
So now you'd probably always still have perhaps a common law cause of action. I mean, I think the reason 8.31 is a better way to go so you can get your attorney fees in an action under that.
All right. Okay.
Senator Higgins moves the A2 amendment. Anybody here want to testify either for or against the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Since the A2 amendment is the provision that's before us, Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2385 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. Right?
I think so.
All right. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you all.
And if cadmium was found in a wedding ring, then Senator Hand's bills would definitely not apply. Is that correct?
But yeah.
Okay. No cohabitation in the bill. Look at this.
Senator Madam Juan? Chair, thank you, Madam Chair and members. The reviser is never want to have the chair carry a bill again because she's always last on the agenda. Senate File 2642, members, is the reviser's bill that we usually do at the beginning of the legislative session, Senator Limmer, not the end of the session. That's why I didn't have you sign on the bill. But there are plenty of spaces we could add you as a co-author to the bill if you would like. This is the traditional technical corrections bill. You can all take a look at it. If there's a particular provision, we name the act or the specific bill that it refers to in the big bill. So if you're wondering why we're tinkering with a particular bill that was passed last year, an act that alarms you, Ms. Timmons is here to answer specific questions. In summary, the bill basically corrects cross-references. It also corrects typographical or grammatical corrections, which this committee could appreciate. It replaces incorrect words, and it also makes some corrections for readability in certain sections. There has also been miscellaneous drafting errors or omissions, and so those are also corrected. There are obsolete or expired language, which are removed or have been repealed, so we correct that. And then in some sections, to help the reader, specifically with respect to some federal or state citations, we add the citations, and we have decided to do, we add the citations by the popular name so that people can know what it is once they read it. There is, I believe, in Section 80, a definition clarification. Section 83 provides that any amendments in the 2010 session that conflicts with the bill supersedes it. We then, in Section 84, required that the revisers substitute references to obsolete rules with the corresponding sections in Minnesota statutes. Chapter 245A or 245B, which replaced the rules. We repeal in Section 85, Subdivision 13 repeals rules for which the statutory authority was repealed. And then there were some editorial conflicts, and so we resolved those in Section 85, Subdivision 8 through 12. I believe that's the gist of the bill. And then there were two areas that were left out, and that is the A10 amendment, which I would like to have adopted as the author's amendment.
Senator Mora moves the A10 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A10 amendment is adopted.
What about discussion, Madam Chair?
We're just adopting the amendment at this point, Senator.
So the amendment adds to the bill, Madam Chair and members. There is a section from the Uniform Probate Code that there were some cross-reference errors, so we just made it correct. And then Section 84 of the amendment was a request by the Seaway Port Authority of Duluth. Apparently, through the tax agreement financing bill last year, there were some errors when they were listing the parcel numbers. And so Section 84 just puts in the correct parcel numbers. And that's the revisor's bill, and Ms. Timmons is here to answer questions if you have any concerns.
Okay. Senator Bitzel.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Senator Moore. Last year, we did have the end-of-session technical corrections bill to correct the problems that we had during the 2009 session. But that bill passed the Senate. It did not pass the House by the time we had to adjourn. So does this bill also incorporates those provisions of the end-of-session corrections bill?
Ms. Timmons?
Yes, I'm Michelle Timmons.
Would you please state your name for the record, please? Thank you.
I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor of statutes. Senator Betzold, Madam Chair, and members. The revisor's bill that we bring forth early in the session typically corrects non-controversial matters, technical corrections. So, and that is not necessarily true of the end-of-session corrections bill. So what we did is that we went through that end-of-session's corrections bill that did not pass last session, and we culled out from that those corrections that were very technical in nature and non-controversial. Those are included in this revisor's bill. Then there are a number of the other corrections from last year that did not pass that will be corrected through other mechanisms, housekeeping bills for particular topic areas, for example, that will come through committee and have much more detailed substantive discussion.
And
Senator
Madam
Bitzel?
Chair, and I'm assuming that the staff and the pertinent legislators in the House and the Senate are going to be aware of those provisions that we tried to correct last year but did not in that bill or this one. So they're aware of it that they have to take action this year?
Yes. We have tried to communicate with those chairs and make sure they know what is in this bill and is not.
Okay. Thank you.
Members, are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, if there are no more other questions and nobody else is here to testify, I'd like to move that Senate File 2642 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Senator Moore has moved Senate File 2642 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
No.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Committee is adjourned.
She said, all those in favor.